Ecclesiastes chapter 3 says, "For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been, that which is to be already has been, and God seeks what has been driven away. Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness, and in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. I said in my heart with regard to the children of man, that God is testing them that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beast is the same. As they die, as one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beast, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all are from the dust, and to the dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of a beast goes down into the earth? So I saw that there is nothing better than that man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him?" Let's pray. Lord God in heaven, you have all things in your hand. You bring us through each season of life. I pray that we would find peace and contentment in the seasons you bring to us, confident that you will give us strength for all circumstances. In Jesus' name, amen. We're going to be in Genesis chapter 23 today. And I'm going to start by simply reading the chapter for us. It came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham. No, wrong chapter. Wrong chapter. "And was old Sarah 100 years. And 27. She was 127 years old. Let me go to a different version so this is not as choppy. We'll go ESV. "Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. And Abraham rose up before his dead and said to the sons of Heth, I am a sojourner, a foreigner among you. Give me property among you for a burying place, that I may bury my dead out of my sight. The sons of Heth answered Abraham, Hear us, my lord, you are a prince of God among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. None of us will withhold you from you his tomb to hinder you from burying your dead. Abraham rose and bowed to the sons of Heth and the people of the land. And he said to them, If you are willing that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and entreat me, Ephron, the son of Zohar, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns. It is at the end of his field. For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence as property for a burying place. Now Ephron was sitting among the sons of Heth, and Ephron the son of Heth answered Abraham in the hearing of all the sons of Heth, of all who went in at the gate of his city. No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the sight of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead. Then Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, But if you will hear me, I give the price of the field. Accept it from me that I may bury my dead there. Ephron answered Abraham, My lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver, what is that between you and me? Bury your dead. Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver that he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver according to the weights current among the merchants. So the field of Ephron in Machpelah, which is to the east of Mamre, the field with the cave that was in it, and all the trees that were in the field throughout its whole area, was made over to Abraham as a possession in the presence of the sons of Heth, before all who went in at the gate of his city. After this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah, east of Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. The field and the cave that is in it were made over to Abraham as property for a burying place by the sons of Heth. So, let's begin with verse 1. Sarah lived 127 years. And I thought it was interesting. In contrast, later in chapter 25, when Abraham dies, it's going to say Abraham died at a good old age full of years. In this case, there's no mention of Sarah having lived a long life. So it's possible that she was a little bit earlier passing than was expected. Maybe not. Sister Jean. Verse 2, Sarah dies in Hebron. And this is very close to Mamre. We talked about Mamre a lot. Remember when we review what Mamre, the Oaks of Mamre, was nearby. You see it there at the top of the screen. So this has got history in Abraham's sojournings. He's been here a couple of times already, right? And here it says she dies in Hebron. Now, what I want to do with these two verses, and then maybe a little hint in verse 4, did to me or made me think about as I was reading these verses was I was like, okay, wait a minute, let me remind myself what's going on. Because we have a mention that Sarah died in Hebron. Now, as you look at the map, just a refresher, you're seeing the southern portion of Israel here. You're seeing the Dead Sea, and then if you go up through the ceiling, you follow the River Jordan, you'll get to the Sea of Galilee, and there's a good bit of Israel even north of that. You know, Dan, the tribe of Dan, the area of Bashan and Mount Hermon, all that's in the very, very northern parts of Israel, of the land of Israel. And if you keep going, you're going to eventually kind of get toward like common area, today area Turkey and those areas of the Middle East, right? So we're way down here at the southern part. If you go a little further south, you're going to hit the Red Sea, you're going to hit Egypt. So we're on our way to Egypt this way. In fact, as you see on the right-hand side of the screen there, you see the River of Egypt. That's not the Nile River, but we've mentioned the River of Egypt before. I don't know if you all remember that. We talked about how that's not the Nile River, but another river in the northern borderish areas of Egypt. And if you think about a lot of times when the borders of Israel are talked about, they say Israel goes down to Egypt. Now, so it's a little... So anyway, here we are. You see Hebron there and Mamre. General, basically, they're right side by side. They're like Bessemer and Birmingham situation. And then, so you see that north of there, you see at the very top of the screen, you have Mount Moriah in Jerusalem, right? And we talked about how, you know, it's thought that Mount Moriah was where Abraham was when he went to the mount on the mountain to sacrifice Isaac. So now we're starting to get into some, okay, yeah, I see how this connects, right? So if I'm looking at this, I'm like, that's interesting, because when you read the very last section, the very last part of chapter 22, before it gets into the family of Abraham's brother, the last thing it says after the recollection of what happened there with Isaac and the mountain and the ram and the sacrifice and all that, the last thing it says is that Abraham returned to his young men, and they rose and went together to Beersheba. So you see where Beersheba is, right? So if they were at Mount Moriah, they would be traveling south to Beersheba. Now, so the question is, and it says actually there that he lived at Beersheba. Not only was he just going to Beersheba, but he actually says that's where he lived. That's where he made home camp. Now, yes, he was a traveler, a sojourner, that sort of thing, but he would, you know, they would make camp and stay in areas for good bits of time. They would live there for a while. And then, you know, they have to leave if the grass was, you know, getting low, and they need to move their animals or whatever. Or maybe, all kind of different reasons they might pack up and move. Maybe God just told them to go somewhere. However, so if you just, you know, at this point, before we get to verse 1, you would read it as he left Mount Moriah and he travels to Beersheba. He's living in Beersheba. Okay, so that's like, okay, interesting. So we have Sarah here dies in Hebron, though, while Abraham's living in Beersheba. Okay, so there's several different ways that could happen. So we'll get to that in a little bit. But the next thing, the next question in my mind is like, in verse 2, when it says, Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. So when I first read that, I think my first inclination was that, you know, Abraham maybe went in to her tent or something like that. The word is broader than that. It could just mean he came to. So now it's like, okay, now I got this idea, but Abraham maybe traveled to where Sarah was, meaning that maybe they weren't together, which is interesting. And that's something that I'd heard somebody suggest. So my thought was, I was like, hey, I remember somebody talking about that maybe they weren't living together at this point. And I was like, well, I want to look at the text and see if that jives with the text. Is it just a possibility, or is it more of a probability based on what the text says? So So that's what I'm kind of thinking through. That's what I'm just sort of like wanting to take y'all on my little journey that I was thinking through is this. So I was like, interesting. So we do have that possibility that Abraham had to go to Hebron to be there after Sarah died or as she was dying. And maybe part of that also is when he talks to the sons of Heth there, he says to them, I am a foreigner and a visitor. The other word for visitor is sojourner, and that's the word chosen in many different translations, but either one of them would work. So that to me, I was like, okay, well, that leaves the door open a little bit. If he's not normally been living there, he would be a visitor there, right? But we got to be careful. We don't want to overinterpret these words. So I was like, okay, well, maybe, maybe not. And then, so now I'm thinking, so we just had this, and part of the point of view that I heard about, he wanted to grab hold of this mention in the last of 22 where it says that Abraham and his servants left, but no mention of Isaac. Now, again, you can't take that too far. You can't say, well, that means he wasn't there. It doesn't mean he wasn't there, but it just means that it wasn't mentioned. So at least the door cracked. So this particular idea that was being purported was building off of that. So I was like, oh, well, maybe, maybe not. So I thought, that made me want to look. I said, well, let's see what happened. I was like, I need, in order to understand if this is like legit or possible or just probable, I mean, or if it's probable or just possible, which it could go either way. We may not get an answer. But I thought the next thing I would like to do is I need to understand Isaac a little bit better here. And I need to see, well, maybe if I look at Isaac's life that's coming down the road, so to speak, in the next chapters, maybe that'll give me a clue. It'll help me decide was this which one this was, or maybe it won't. So I started looking at Isaac's life down the road, and it's because there's no mention of Isaac in this first four verses. It doesn't say anything about Isaac being there or not being there. So it's like it's just an unknown. We don't know because we're not told. But the question would be like, you know, maybe we're told later. So I thought, well, I need to look at Isaac's life right quick and see what's going on there. So if we rewind, we remember that he was born. We know that we have text talking about his birth. We have text talking about he was being weaned and there being a big party. And then we have the text talking about being taken to the mountain. We talked about the potential of his different ages during that time. Possible ages then. And then that's kind of where we are, right? And then, like I said, there's this, it's not specifically mentioned on the return. But see, so I thought, well, when's the next time Isaac shows up in the story? So I could get a little idea. And he said, next time he shows up is in chapter 24, verse 62 rather. And in that verse, it says that he returns from Beer Lahiroi. Does anybody remember what Beer Lahiroi was? Yeah, it's on there. But does anybody remember the significance of that location?
Was it where God talked to Rebecca?
Hagar? It's where Hagar said, this is where the Lord provides, and when he provided the water when after they had been cast out. And you do notice there's a question mark because it's not an exact known location, but it's presumed in this general area. So he returns to, it says in that verse, he returns from there to the Negev. The Negev is basically this area, just whole big area right here, southern Israel, Judah area. It definitely includes Rehoboth, and probably includes Beersheba, and then south as well. So it says there he returns from Negev. And this does tie into our story because right here, he returns there, And he returns there, and it's in the context of Abraham's servant bringing, what was his name? Bringing Rebekah. So anyway, this is the context of here about Isaac is, he says, and Isaac returned from Beer Lahai to the Negev, and he's there when the servant brings Rebekah. And it says there that Rebekah was a comfort to Isaac after the death of Sarah. So we have our link here. We have, death of Sarah. Come back. So now my question is, or three things come to mind. So first of all, we have Isaac has gone to and returned from Beer Lahai. And I'm just going to call it BLR from now on, because it's easier to say. BLR, like BLM, BLR. He's gone and returned from BLR. And this BLR was the location of the well. It's in the located in the wilderness of Paran. And it's and so it has a tie with Ishmael. Okay? His half-brother. That's interesting to me. And then I'm like, okay, if I keep looking at Isaac's life, later in chapter 25, Abraham dies. And we read there that Abraham dies, Isaac and Ishmael bury him. And they bury him where? In the same cave that Abraham's buying here for Sarah. Another connection. So I'm like, that's interesting. Now, Isaac is going to end up in Hebron eventually. But the question is like, you know, he's mourning for his mother. We don't have any mention of him being there, but he could have been there. And he has this sojourn. He has his sojourn, apparently, down all the way to BLR. Well, that actually got me thinking about Isaac and Rebekah, and I got to reading more about that. And I got on a little bit of a rabbit trail, but I wanted to share a little bit of it with you. I think it's gonna be somewhat relative because I think it gives us a good framework for thinking about all these because if nothing else, it's gonna prepare us for what's coming down the road because we're fixing to have Isaac and Rebekah and we're gonna have the twins born and then we're gonna have Jacob and all his sojourners and stuff like that. So So here we have Isaac receiving Rebekah as a comfort for his mother's death. So that's like, whoa. How long has it been after his mother's death before Rebekah shows up on the scene? You know, how long did this take? Because, you know, that would be, you know, if he's still mourning her, was it just a few months? In which case, he's in the Negev, and his mother dies in Hebron. Could he have got from Hebron and done all his traveling in just a few months? Seems a little bit, this is a little bit difficult. Actually, it turns out, I did look up, and from Hebron to Beersheba is about 12 miles. From Beersheba to this area where they think BLR was is about 24 miles. Looks bigger on there. I mean, I would have thought it had been longer. Now, of course, we're walking. We're not taking our truck, you know, down the road or whatever. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know how long it would have taken for him to travel that far. But I wanted to know. Like, is there anything that I can look at scriptures to get at? How long did it take to do that? Well, Could you flip that over to the other one right quick for me? To the
push the button?
Yeah. I had everything set up so that I wouldn't have to go scrolling through stuff for y'all. And then I lost it all a minute ago, so give me just a second. So what I did was I did some research, and I think I've come up with a timeline of dates and when things happen with people's ages, Isaac, Jacob, that sort of thing. So I'm hopeful. Now I do want to put forward one caveat. As you recall, when we did the generations of those like between Noah and Abraham, we saw that there were some discrepancies in some of the text, right? We talked about the discrepancy between the Septuagint years and the Masoretic text years. Y'all remember that? Say no if you don't, so I can know you don't remember. Okay, yeah. So I did not go and look to see if there was a bunch of differences between just what I found in what I presume is from Masoretic text in ESV and KJV and those numbers. I didn't go looking to see if there was a controversy between these numbers of the ages. So this would be based on, I guess, Masoretic text ages, just regular KJV, ESV type numbers. So like, you know, if it said in Genesis that Abraham was 175 when he died, that's what I'm going with. We know that Isaac was 60 years old when Jacob and Esau were born. And we know that, this is where it's coming back to me now. Anyway, Rebekah was barren for 20 years. That puts Isaac at 40 when he's married to Rebekah. And hang on. And if you use that and you use Sarah's age of 127 and you use Abraham's age was 10 years older than Sarah, that put Abraham at 137. And Isaac was born when Abraham was 100. So that means Isaac was 37 years old. Do y'all follow that?
When Sarah died.
Sure. Yeah. So Isaac is 37 when Sarah dies because of that. And Isaac is 40 when he marries Rebekah. Because Rebekah was barren for 20 years. So that means Isaac was 60 when Jacob was born. And it's in the context, she's barren for 20 years in the context of after she's married, she doesn't have a child for 20 years. Plus, we know, I think I'm almost positive there's a verse that says that Jacob and Esau were born when Isaac was 60. So that pushes back the marriage probably to 20 years. I guess it's not 100% definitive, is it? She says she was barren for 20 years. It would be irrelevant until she's married if she stayed a virgin. So maybe a little question on that. But if that be the case, 37 when his mother died, 40 when he gets married. So there's 3 years between there. That answered my question. So I came up with some other interesting tidbits while I was doing that. And I thought I'd just share them with you. These are rabbit trails. These have got nothing necessarily to do, well, definitively with today. But I thought it was very interesting that because of these time schedules here, Rebekah was barren for 20 years, and we talked about that. Abraham would have been 160 years old when Jacob and Esau were born. That was interesting. And Jacob then would have been 15 years old when Abraham died. So Jacob knew Abraham, his grandfather. And so my interesting points from all this, like there's a ton up there that's interesting actually to me, but we know that it's interesting to me that Sarah, Rebekah, Rachel and Leah all had issues with barrenness during their marriages. I thought that was very interesting. However, we have no ages for Rebecca or Leah or Rachel, so we don't know like what age these barrenness happened when they were barren. We know that Isaac was 60 when he followed Jacob and Esau, and Jacob was likely 71 to 91 as he fathers his 12 sons. And to me, that was like interesting because that really puts into context Abraham. You know, that this he's not the only one having children into his 90s. So I thought that was interesting. And Isaac was 60, but he never had any other children that we know of besides Jacob and Esau. All right, so we talked about Sarah dies in Hebron, and also when it talks about Isaac received Rebecca as and she was a comfort to him, it says in that same scripture that he put Rebecca in the tent of Sarah. So, you know, this is 3 years after his mother died. So that sounds to me more like, again, I was trying to make Sarah linkages here because this is Sarah's what we're talking about today, her death. And so I don't think it would be that the tent was still standing per se, but that they had this tent. And the tent of Sarah would be more of like put her in the place of the matriarch of the family. So there likely was still a tent, and they likely did pitch it for her. But the point was not so much that it was Sarah's tent as much as it was Rebecca came in to be the replacement for Sarah and the family. Sarah's gone. Now, that brings a question forward because by this time, Abraham had already remarried. I believe I got my timeline right. It's possible, though, that he had not remarried yet. So I probably shouldn't go there because I didn't really ferret that out all the way. But I thought it was interesting, this little phrase, in the tent of Sarah. And it seemed to me it probably meant more like Rebecca came in to take Sarah's place as matriarch of the family. The question would be, why was Sarah in Hebron? And so the idea that I had read about or heard about was that after this whole incident on the mountain, there was like a family split up. It doesn't appear to me we have definitive enough information to say that was for sure the case. It could have been that they were on their way back from the mountain, and that when the text says Abraham lived in Beersheba, that could just, you know, it doesn't have to be purely, I got something in my eye. It doesn't have to be purely chronological, because in the text it says they're on the mountain, he lived in Beersheba, but it could be that they're coming back from the mountain, and Sarah dies in Hebron. They're in Hebron still. They're traveling slowly. They're still in Hebron. Except that would be that mean that they were there for 3 years. And eventually they get back to Beersheba. The other thing that has to happen is, because of the timeline, Isaac has to come off the mountain. His mother has died. And then he has potentially 3 years before Rebecca comes in the scene. So there's plenty of time there for him to have traveled and done his traveling down to the south and then end up in the Negev to receive Rebecca. However, I will say that the door seems to me still be open because the next chapter we're going to read about Abraham sending off his servant to get the wife, but we don't have any. Abraham's not in the story as Rebecca's brought back to Isaac. So it doesn't mean he wasn't there, but he's just not definitively there. It's not to say, it says that Rebecca says, "Who's that man?" And the answer is, "That's my master, Isaac." So the servant of Abraham is calling Isaac his master. And that's not a weirdo thing either, though. That's very common. He's the heir. So he's just as much his master as Abraham is, from the eyes of the servant. So not that that's, again, it's all these little cracked doors, and you wonder which one you should go through. And when there's nothing definitive to tell you, you should just simply look at it and say, well, there's a cracked door. I don't know what the answer is to that. So I don't want to overemphasize it. But it was something that I'd heard, and so I wanted to use this opportunity to ferret it out a little bit. Now, I know that was a bunch of rambling and a bunch of rabbit trails. So did I confuse anybody? Did that bring up any additional questions? Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm curious if you can flesh out the idea that the tent would represent some sort of family matriarchy. I think that's a strange term to give her.
I don't think the family was a matriarchy. I just think she was the matriarch of the family. She would be the head woman of the family. I mean, she was the number one wife of Abraham, and therefore she would hold the position of honor and of authority in terms of the woman's responsibilities and what she did for the family, all under Abraham. Now, so it was a patriarchy, but she was the matriarch of the family.
So she was like a queen. It would be a similar connection. King.
I would think so. I think Abraham would look to her and say, all the womanly duties, you have control over. I mean, she had Hagar and maybe other handmaidens and slaves that to direct and to make sure there was always food available and the clothing and all the things that Proverbs 31 woman would do. That's what I mean by Sarah being the matriarch of the family. Not the
flesh out that the tent is symbolizing that position. Do we have other examples of that? Where are you coming from with that?
Okay, I am thinking through this idea that if I'm right on the chronology and it's been 3 years since her death, would they have just continued to have a tent sitting there empty for 3 years? And at what point would they finally take it down and not have a tent anymore? So it would be like the tent could be a real tent, but whether they just kept it up until there was another woman to possess it or not, I don't know. I mean, it's possible, but
why does the woman have to live in that tent? It is her tent. It says he took her into the tent. So I'm really trying to flesh out, do you have something that's taking you that direction to say, this is what that means? I have examples in my family where a house lies empty, and the son is very attached to that house because that's where his mother married. And so to bring his wife into that could be specifically comforting.
Okay.
And not,
as I recollect, I didn't say it was not potentially literal. I didn't say that it had to not be literal, but I also felt like this would be, because he put her in Sarah's tent, it wasn't like he made her made her her own tent, Of course, I don't even get the idea that he was necessarily expecting her, per se. But maybe he was. Maybe, I don't know what. There's nothing in the text that says Abraham told Isaac, "I'm sending somebody off to get you a wife." In fact, in the text, it reads more like Abraham just decided to do it. And now, of course, Isaac knows who this servant is. I mean, he's not surprised to see the servant. He doesn't like, who are you? Oh, yeah, you're my dad's servant. No, he knew the servant. And when his servant shows up with Rebecca, he it's like, oh, this is my wife. So he puts her in the tent of what I would consider to be, it could literally be the tent that Sarah occupied.
Which is what he said. So
I'm fine with that. I didn't say she was on Abraham's level.
She becomes the matriarch of the family.
No, I did not say. I don't know. She does not become the matriarch of the family. Abraham was the patriarch of the family, and then Sarah, being his head wife, would be the matriarch of the family. That doesn't mean she's the head of him.
I said.
Huh?
That's the same statement I said, that Sarah was the matriarch of the family, and you had made the point that when Rebecca came, putting her into the tent made her the matriarch of the family.
I guess there must be some other cultural things I've read about that go along with that. I cannot point to them, though. That would be my answer. Yeah, no, that's...
It seemed a stretch, and so I was just looking for, well, I see this over here with David and whatever or something, but...
You could be right. You could be that they, as they sojourned, they pulled all the tents up, packed them up, and every time they got somewhere else, they put them all back out, including this empty one for Sarah. Could it be the case? I would just think that'd be, I don't know. I don't know why. I have no reason to know why they would do that. But you have a personal example of people maintaining something like that.
I'm not saying that's an example. I'm just saying the scripture says he put her in her tent.
I realize that.
I was just curious if you had something, that would be cool. I'm just curious because I just think that's.
No, I just thought it odd that if 3 years later they'd still be having the tent up. So it didn't necessarily. I wondered. It's like that's kind of odd to me. Doesn't mean it's not right because I'm going to tell you in just a minute that we don't need to interpret the actions of these individuals by what we think a lot of times, because we're in a different context of life. I mean, we do things differently. We see things differently. Not like so differently we can't understand, but we can certainly misinterpret something in their ancient culture, in their older culture, in their different culture. Even if you want to just say, they're just the difference between the culture of a person in Africa today and in our culture, they're different. And we could easily go over, or they could come over here for that matter, and see something going on and completely misunderstand it because it's a completely different culture. So I'm going to say that's why I'm saying that it just seemed odd to me that they would do that. But it could be perfectly normal for them to do that. That's why I said I don't think it's out of the question that it was literally sitting there. Her literal tent was still there. Now, it could be that he was expecting Rebecca, but I don't get that necessarily from the text. So when I take together, it's been 3 years, I don't see anything that indicates he's expecting her. You know, it seems odd. So is there another reason? Could it be both? Could it be like a this and, not an and or, but a both and situation? So I would see that it seemed to me in those cultures that there would be a woman in charge of the womanly things of the family. That's what I'm terming using as a term the word matriarch for. Not that the family was a matriarchal structure, and that would mean that the matriarch controlled everything, including the husbands or the husband. So in that case, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying like my wife is the matriarch of my family, but yet I am the leader and still the head of my family. So that's the way I'm using that term. And it seems logical to me that the tent could be representative of her status in the family. So they literally could have pulled out the tent and put it up. Because, like, look, this is where the head woman, the head wife, it might be something decorative about it that was different from all the other tents. So you knew that's who that tent belongs to. In like an honoring kind of way. So I'm probably pulling from a lot of other little tidbits of knowledge or at least tidbits of what I've heard about cultures and stuff like that. So that's where that came from. It just seemed odd, so I was thinking through it.
So why would they have to set up the tent every time, even though Sarah's dead?
They wouldn't have to, but if Isaac wasn't expecting her to come, then they could have pulled it. I guess they could have pulled it out and set it up. Even if they had pulled out a literal physical tent, which is fine, it's like in my head that, you know, she was the wife, and she would have been the Proverbs 31 woman in charge of all the slaves and handmaidens, and so she had a position of authority and power not above Abraham, but above a bunch of the family. Because the family, remember, the family was, I mean, while there was the blood family, you know, those, the slaves and servants were part of the household, considered part of the household in a sense. So she would have authority over them, and many of them anyway, maybe not all of them. Certainly she had it over Hagar. So she decided she was going to be cast out. So, like I said, let's all, include me, be careful not to read into ancient events in our based on our modern realities, and read the word carefully and as close to the original as possible, which, literal tent, is fine with me. Following the text and not translations at times. Work to get to the point, these are admonitions based on this. Work to get to the point that you are not going to commentaries or other people for your understandings, but reading and carefully considering as you read the text. Use the ideas of others as helpful sounding boards. And ways to consider another perspective, but pray and submit to God's leading as to how you understand the scriptures. So those are my admonitions from all that. Okay, well, next section, verse 3. Abraham stops mourning here and goes to the sons of Heth to acquire a burial place. And this is why I read Ecclesiastes 3 this morning, because it talks about that there's for everything there's a time and a season. Life being a season, life being a series of seasons and times. And we transition from one to the next in God's hand in providential ways. And that's how life goes. Life is a series of multiple seasons. You'll be in a season of life and you'll flow into another season of life. And sometimes that flow in there is like a gentle ride across the lake. But other times it's like going over rapids and over a waterfall. You crash into the next season of life. But God's through it. God's with you He knows it's coming. He knows what He has in store for you. He's with you, and He uses His providential means and ways to take you from one season to the next season of life. We can read about seasons of life in Genesis 8:22. Which says, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. Those are all different physical seasons of life. Each day is, you know, its own little mini season. We have Psalm 30, verse 5, and 31:15. Somebody want to get 31:15? In Psalm 30 verse 5, it says, for God's, His being the Lord's anger is but for a moment, and His favor is for a lifetime. Weeping may tarry for the night, but joy comes in the morning. I got the next one.
My times are in thy hand. Deliver me from the hand of my enemies and from them that persecute me.
So the Lord is in control. He delivers us from different situations and seasons. And then the last one I have is 1 Corinthians 13:11. It says, when I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child, reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. So that's another season of life that everyone transitions out of. Transition from childhood to adulthood. And so because of the seasonality of life, because it's inherent in what God has created, and we see it throughout His Word, we make a mistake when we hold on to things in conditions too firmly. So that would be a mistake. You're in a season of life, and you may be like loving it. Just don't hold on too tight, because there's another season of life coming at some point or another. Doesn't mean don't enjoy that season if you can. And when it's a season of life that's hard, Know that there's that God's got you, and there's going to be a window. There's going to be a door. There's going to be an end to the tunnel, and God's going to be there to bring you through to the other side, one way or another. He does that for all His children. He says that He won't provide, He won't put on us anything that we cannot handle. And look, we are all changing. The person that you are today will not be the person you are 10 years from now. God's providential means and ways that He brings different people in your life, different situations in your life. You will grow and you will change. Lord willing, through sanctification, for the better. But you will look back 10 years and you'll go, I can't believe I thought that. I can't believe I did that. I can't believe I, whatever. Because you grow, because life changes you. And it's all for our good. And here Abraham mourns, and then he stops because the time of mourning was over. And he goes and he purchases the cave there. And that's what the next verses 4 through 20 are dealing with. In these verses, we have the exact, not the exact, we have the specifics of Abraham and his dealings to purchase this cave to accomplish his purpose of burying his wife. And it says that he purchased them from the sons of Heth. Sons of Heth were apparently, or presumably, Heth being the second son of Canaan. And now, I'm pretty sure everybody's translation has Hittites here. And from what I can understand, I mean, literally in the Hebrew, it's sons of Heth. The Hittites that current archaeology has discovered are actually more northern in their geography, more up Turkey, modern day Turkey area, and they speak of these as the Anatolian Hittites. And the reason I wanted to distinguish these, it could be that the sons of Heth are the progenitors, then they, all moved kind of to the north there. Because currently we're not in that area geographically. They're in Hebron area and, that. So the understanding is that, I mean, at this point they're not so large and powerful people that they go all the way up into Turkey. There's also, I think there's evidence, I did not take as much time to dig into this, that there's a reasonable chance that the word Hethites transitioned to Hittites, and that's why they're written sons of Heth in the text, but then later we hear all about the Hittites right in our biblical text. Because they're lumped in with the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hittites, and all this, and so it's likely that the sons of Heth are the same group rendered Hittites. But I didn't want it to necessarily, I didn't want to accidentally confound them with the archaeologically discovered Hittites that are up north. Could be they're the same. May not be the same. I don't really understand why they would translate it Hittites when they could just say sons of Heth, which is why I read it that way. That's what it is in the Hebrew. So that was, I guess, to me it's less confusing just to call them sons of Heth. More interesting than that, however, is verse 6. And we have the sons of Heth here refer to Abraham as Adonai Nashi Elohim. That's what they call him. And if I get back there right quick. And this is most often rendered Lord, Prince of God. We don't have any indication, we don't have a verb here to to help us interpret the Elohim here. But literally it would be Lord, Prince, Gods, if you took it straight from the Hebrew. So what I find interesting is that these would be people who possess and populated the area of the Oaks of Mamre. And we've already talked about Oaks of Mamre and their connection with the Elohim of Elohim multiple times. Not only Yahweh, the Most High Elohim, but apparently it was a grove to worship gods, to worship the Elohim. And therefore, I find it interesting that potentially Abraham had developed a reputation. Remember, he was in Mamre a lot. And now these people who populate that land, populate that area, call him potentially, you could render this Lord, Prince of the Gods, as if somehow they look at Abraham and they see him as, if nothing else, this man who speaks to an Elohim, or an Elohim who speaks to him. So I find it just very interesting that they do that. They give him that title, Lord, Prince, Gods, or Lord, Prince, God. Either way, it's a title of respect from them. And it comes across to me as pretty high respect that they would call him that. So then we have verses 7 through 17, which these are the verses describing the transaction over the land. And I wanted to pull out a few things from this. At first, this is not really, there's really no haggling going on here. Haggling is like bartering. There's really no bartering going on, it turns out. It's not really haggling. It appears to me more like this is like the, like we talked about, the respect for Abraham and the cultural manners of the time, and possibly even fear of Abraham by these people as being a prince of the gods or prince of God. So he just said, "Oh, just take it. Just take it here. No, you can have the land." But it is my understanding that in the Semitic, Arabian type cultures, this is how it goes. You're like, especially like in the marketplaces, you're going to go in and you're going to like talk back and forth about something before you buy it. In the marketplaces, you're literally haggling. You're like, you know, hey, I want $1,000 for this. Nah, I'll give you $10. Oh, no. And you have to haggle down to some of the price. It's like expected in a lot of these cultures. I don't really think that's what was going on here, but I do think there may have been some of the cultural influence. But it could be that they feared Abraham and said, "Hey, no, you're Abraham. You can just have it." But Abraham did much like he did when he rescued Lot, and he came back, and the king of Sodom wanted to give him all these spoils of war, and he said, "Nope, I'm not going to take those." He refuses the gift. Now, there's several things that you can take out of this. I think are good principles of life, wise things. Principle number one is that there's some things worth paying for. There's nothing wrong with accepting a gift, but there's some things worth paying for as well. Principle number two is, in this, I think especially in this case, in many cases in life, payment makes your transaction more solid when you've actually paid for it. Then there can't be any question later about who owns whatever the item is. There's no way, you know. And in this case, we see that there are witnesses, and the transaction was done in the gate, which is like saying, my understanding would be today it would be like going to the courthouse and filing papers. It's like done legally. Another good principle here is when you're just dealing with business transactions, the owner sets the price. Somebody says, you know, say, hey, you know, what do you want for that? And they say, well, what do you give me? No, the owner sets the price. It's just a wise thing to do. And in this case, that's what happens. Now, he couches it in a bunch of respectful, maybe even just, it could be cultural, could be respectful, either one. He couches it. The guy says, oh, it's, you know, what is 400 shekels of silver between me and you? You just take it. Well, that's his way of telling Abraham what he thinks it's worth. And so Abraham goes with it. He doesn't haggle. Another principle, if it's a fair price, pay it. You don't always have to haggle. And by doing this, Abraham shows strength and wisdom and respect for that other party. So again, we have draw out these principles from this section. And then finally, in verses 17 through 20, we have the conclusion, which is, you know, what we already knew was coming because we had a spoiler, right? And Sarah is buried in the cave that Abraham buys. And later, Abraham will also be buried in the same cave, and there'll be three other people buried in that same cave. And so, who knows one?
Leah.
Whoa. Who knows one? Raise your hand. I think I heard Nate say one.
Jacob.
You got one?
Leah.
And you got? He had yours. There's one more. Who's got
Sarah.
The? I already said Sarah and Abraham. Besides Sarah and Abraham, TJ?
Isaac.
You said who?
Jacob.
Rebecca.
You said Leah, and you said Isaac. That's right. Those are the three. Isaac, Rebecca, and Leah. No. Isaac, Rebecca. No, wait a minute.
Jacob.
There's four more.
Jacob.
Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, and Leah. That was four, not three.
Rebecca wasn't buried there.
Did I say Rebecca? Rebecca was buried there.
I don't think of Rachel, not
Rebecca. Rachel was not.
Rachel
was not. Where was Rachel buried?
On Bethlehem.
On the trip.
Bethlehem. Right. Okay. No, Joseph's bones were not taken back to the cave. I did look that up too, because I had to make sure. Joseph was buried in Shechem. Shechem, I'm pretty sure Shechem's where they put up the tabernacle when they got there. Pretty sure. It was Shechem. It was the first place for the tabernacle, but it could be. It was Shiloh. I have him backwards. He was buried in Shechem. His bones were placed in Shechem. So, to conclude, number one, take care as you read your Bible. Study it. Listen to the Spirit. Read it for yourself. Number two, there's a biblical flow of life as we go through different seasons. Trust God in them. Number three, we see the blessing of God on Abraham. He has respect from those around him. He has power and wealth, possibly even over Elohim. He has grace and wisdom. And as he and we follow God's law, the results will make you look wise and bless you.